From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Ed Morin, bringing you the news on This Day in Maine, Friday, December 29, 2017. And on this day, a significant change could make it a lot more difficult for groups pushing citizens' initiatives in Maine. And looking back on the lives of some memorable Mainers we lost in 2017. That's ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org.
At first glance, a new bill from Maine's Secretary of State contains mostly a list of minor housekeeping changes to state election laws. But tucked inside is a big change that could make it much harder for groups pushing citizens' initiatives onto the state ballot. The proposal comes at a time when both Democrats and Republicans in the legislature are eyeing ways to curb an explosion in ballot initiatives. Steve Missler reports.
Getting a citizen-initiated question on the ballot requires the signatures of over 61,000 registered Maine voters. And the easiest way to collect those signatures is on Election Day, right at the polling place. That's why it's common for voters to cast their ballot and then encounter campaign workers asking them to sign petitions that can propose anything from raising the minimum wage and legalizing marijuana to changing Maine tax law.
I mean, this is a tradition that has been part of how Maine democracy works for decades.
Anna Keller, director for the Maine Citizens for Clean Elections and the League of Women Voters of Maine, says a provision in the Secretary of State's bill would eliminate that easy access to voters. It bans the collection of signatures for ballot initiatives inside polling places and moves it outside, way outside, to at least 51 feet from the entrance of a polling place and from the pathway between the parking lot and the entrance to the building. It's a significant change, one that Keller says eliminates a key tool for ballot campaigns to obtain the signatures they need to propose laws to voters.
So without the ability to do that, it would make it much harder for more citizen initiatives to get on the ballot. And it would give an advantage to groups that have a lot of money at the beginning, so groups that are funded usually from big donors out of state.
Keller says the proposal would also tilt the playing field to favor campaigns who pay petition circulators a lot of money for each signature they collect. That's because well-funded campaigns may be able to withstand the polling place ban by simply paying more per signature over a longer period of time, while a volunteer-based campaign may not have the cash or the manpower. Keller also notes that the proposal comes at a time when lawmakers are increasingly frustrated with citizen-approved laws, but have so far been unable to pass any restrictions.
We've seen more and more efforts to try different angles to make it harder for groups to get on the ballot, and this is probably the most extreme of those.
No, this is not really designed to address those concerns at all, and this is not coming from the legislator.
Maine Secretary of State Matt Dunlap insists that his proposal is not an attempt to appease lawmakers who have so far been unable to curb use of ballot initiatives. He says it's designed to address concerns by municipal election officials and the public about an uptick in petition activity in and near polling places.
And from voters. You know, voters have complained for years about running the gauntlet in the polling place. And it's depending on how zealous people are about gathering signatures, it makes a lot of extra work for the wardens trying to police things and keep things orderly in a polling place.
Dunlap says the complaints have been spurred by signature collections, campaigning by candidates, exit polling by news organizations, and groups opposing ballot initiatives, all of which would be banned from within the proposed 50-foot buffer area.
I would agree that this is a major change. But it's one that's worth discussing because we do get a lot of complaints from voters about, say, running the gauntlet in the polling station.
Dunlap's office has supported such changes in the past, but none have passed the legislature. And given the anticipated pushback from interest groups who see the initiative process as a critical tool, he isn't overly confident that this one will become law either. The legislature's Veterans and Legal Affairs Committee will hold a public hearing on the proposal on Wednesday. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
The Maine Board of Dental Practice has found in favor of a Lewiston dentist accused of putting the health and safety of his patients in immediate jeopardy. Dr. Jan Kippax had his license temporarily suspended about a year ago after 18 patients filed nearly 200 complaints against him. But today, the same board that suspended Kippax decided not to take further action. Patty White reports.
The complaints against Kippax alleged, among other things, that he extracted the wrong teeth from patients, performed procedures before anesthesia took effect, and continued with painful procedures even when patients asked him to stop. After his license was suspended, the Maine Board of Dental Practice held several hearings over the fall to determine what, if any, further action to take against Dr. Kippax. Attorneys for the state tried to prove that Kippax is incompetent and unprofessional and narrowed the case to 5 patients and 64 complaints. But their case was dealt a major blow in November when an expert witness concluded that Kippax had not violated the standard of care. The state and the board subsequently dismissed all but 4 complaints against him. Still, the state struggled to make a solid case because of conflicting testimony between patients, Kippax, and his staff. In closing arguments on Friday, Assistant Attorney General James Bowie reminded the board that patients had clear memories of their experiences, while Kippax and his staff could not recall the incidents.
So it comes down to a question of credibility.
But just prior to the closing arguments, another expert, Dr. John Kelly, a retired oral surgeon from Mass General, also testified in favor of Kippax. Kelly said that Kippax administered appropriate sedation and anesthesia. As for continuing with painful procedures even when patients asked Kippax to stop, Kelly said it's not uncommon for patients to feel pain for just an instant at the last moment a tooth is pulled.
Generally speaking, that means the tooth's already been removed from its initial location, and it's certainly safe and reasonable to proceed to continue to take it out of the mouth.
Kippax's attorney James Bellow told the board in his closing arguments that they could not ignore testimony from multiple experts that came to the same conclusion.
There's only one outcome that can occur in this case, whether you like it or not, because it's the state's burden of proof to prove this by expert testimony, and they failed to do so.
The board agreed. It determined that the state had not shown through a preponderance of evidence that Kippax violated standards of care in the remaining complaints. Afterwards, Bellow said he was pleased with the decision.
And I applaud the board for listening diligently and upholding the law and the requirements of the law that are designed both to protect the public and licensees in the state of Maine.
It's unclear whether the state will pursue the other patients and complaints it did not include in this set of hearings. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Frigid temperatures forecast this weekend are proving too much even for rugged Mainers. A pair of popular polar dips planned for New Year's Eve and New Year's Day are being canceled or rescheduled. As Susan Sharon reports, organizers are concerned for participants' safety.
For the first time in 30 years, the New Year's Day lobster dip held in Old Orchard Beach to benefit Special Olympics is being postponed until Saturday, January 13th. Participant and public relations director Lisa Bird says the numbers forecast for that date are looking a whole lot better than they are for Monday, when the wind chill factor is expected to drop well below zero.
I'm not going to lie that I'm, a little excited about 28 degrees as opposed to negative 16. It certainly makes me look forward to the event a lot more.
Bird says the biggest concern was putting dippers at risk for hypothermia. And so, with the advice from their medical team, organizers concluded it wasn't safe. That was also the conclusion reached by the Natural Resources Council of Maine, which has been sponsoring a polar bear dip on New Year's Eve for the past decade as a way to highlight climate change in Casco Bay. Dr. Tony Owens is an ER physician and longtime dipper who counseled the group to pull the plug.
When I recruited my team for Team Hype ER Thermia, I said everybody will come out of the water with a smile on their face, and that's the backdrop against which we wanted to do the dip.
Unlike research into marathons run in the heat and humidity, Owen says not much is known about the safety of cold water dips. But the consensus around Maine was that with an extremely cold air temperature combined with a stiff wind, taking the plunge wouldn't be a safe or fun experience. And while the dip is off until next year, the Polar Bear 5K dash planned for Sunday morning is still on. Extra warm hats, mittens, and socks are definitely in order. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
As the year comes to an end, we look back on the lives of some memorable Mainers we lost in 2017. They defended people in court and on the battlefield, created great art and moving music, shaped public policy, and gave us an official state soft drink. Erwin Gratz has their stories.
Look up moxie in the dictionary and you'll see the words energy and courage. Attorney Dan Lilly had moxie.
They've taken a case, a small case, they've blown it into to a nightmare, but they're not prepared to go forward on it.
If you ever got into serious trouble, Dan Lilly was the guy to call. Dan Lilly died in March. He was 79. The judiciary lost Bernard Devine. He served on the district court for so long, nearly 50 years, that the Maine District Court in Portland was named for him. Bernard Devine was 92. David Rockefeller is best remembered as longtime president of Chase Manhattan Bank, but we remember him here because, like others in the Rockefeller clan, he had a special attachment to Mount Desert Island and Acadia National Park. His father, John D. Rockefeller Jr., donated 11,000 acres to the park and had the carriage roads built. David raised $10 million to rehabilitate those carriage roads and create a fund to ensure their future upkeep. David Rockefeller was 101. Alan Hutchinson helped preserve land all around the state. He was founding executive director of the Forest Society of Maine. During his 20 years, the society grew to become one of the five largest land trusts in the U.S. Alan Hutchinson was 70.
Sweet angels come nearer.
The oldest practicing Shaker, Sister Frances Carr, died January 2nd this year. She was 89. The Shakers are the religious community on Sabbath-day Lake, a community based on what Sister Frances described as the three C's.
It's a sharing of all things in common, so it's a religious communism, a living in community. We're also a celibate community, and we also believe in the confession of sin.
Sister Frances acknowledged the rigor of Shakerism wasn't for everybody, but once she became a Shaker, she never felt alone. Artist Dalla Vipkar died this past March. She said one of her favorite quotes was from Winston Churchill.
Most people, their work and their pleasure is separate. And for some people, their work and their pleasure are the same, and they're the lucky ones. I'm just one of the lucky ones.
Actually, we were pretty lucky, too. We got to see her fanciful illustrations of animals in children's books, museum exhibitions, on posters and T-shirts for the Common Ground Fair, and for our former great TV auctions. She was 99. Author Robert Persig wrote the popular philosophy book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Frequently people get the idea that Zen is something apart from the everyday world, and it never is. And I'm trying to bring that point home with the use of motorcycle maintenance.
The book was published in 1974. Persig's other work, Lila, An Inquiry into Morals, was published 17 years later. Persig said he'd written all he had to say and retreated to a quiet life in South Berwick. It was there he died last April at 88. Peter Alphon, like his father Harold, put his wealth to work for others, giving money in support of education and health care, among other causes. He supported institutions in Maine and in the Caribbean. Peter Alphon went to Africa earlier this year, contracted malaria there, and died. He was 65. Dave Cloutier was a standout running back for the University of Maine football team. An injury interrupted an early pro career, but also led to him signing on with the then Boston Patriots as a defensive back and kick returner in 1964. That made Cloutier the first Mainer ever to play for the now New England Patriots. He died in Florida at 78. Neil Rold was a legislator from a different time.
There was a great collegiality, you know. I mean, we would get out there and beat each other's brains out on the floor, but then we'd go have a drink.
Rold, a Democrat, represented York in the legislature from 1974 to 1990. In later years, he wrote about Maine history and about U.S. actions during the Holocaust. He was a member of many Maine boards and commissions, including Maine Publics. Neil Rold lived to be 85. Kurt Messerschmitt lived some 70 years longer than Adolf Hitler would have wished. Messerschmitt, a native German Jew, survive stays in concentration camps, including the notorious Auschwitz. He eventually moved to the U.S. and put his musical talent to work as a cantor, someone who chants the ancient Hebrew prayer. Messerschmitt was cantor at Portland's Temple Beth El for 34 years. He and wife Sonia also gave public witness to their World War II experiences. Sonia died in 2010. Kurt Messerschmitt died this past September. He was 102. Several members of the Nazi leadership eventually stood trial for war crimes stemming from the Holocaust. Mel Stone, a Portland native, was there in Nuremberg to see some of the proceedings. He was helping Germans rebuild it after the war. Stone went on to own several newspapers in Maine, later TV and radio stations, and was the first president of the New England Press Association. Mel Stone died in November at 96. Richard Dudman was a reporter taken prisoner by the Viet Cong in Cambodia in 1970. He and two other younger journalists were held for over a month.
I felt it was my responsibility to keep their spirits up. So I said, you know, if we get out of here alive, we're going to have one hell of a good story.
They did, but it was only one story among many during Dudman's award-winning career. He retired to Ellsworth, but continued to take on reporting projects for his old paper, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and write columns for the Bangor Daily News. Richard Dudman died this summer at 99. Robert Coles Jr.'s war story began abruptly on the date people of his generation would never forget. Coles, just shy of 18, was aboard the Navy frigate Bagley in Hawaii on December 7, 1941, when he saw planes.
I says, no, this is not maneuvers. This is Sunday, and it's a crowded harbor. This is war.
Robert Coles Jr. returned to Pearl for last year's 75th anniversary observance. He died in November at 93. Linda Abramson's daughter says Linda decided to run for Portland City Council so she could stop the city from charging women to use the bathroom at Portland Jetport. She won, the charge went away, and Linda went on to become the city's second woman mayor. Linda Abramson was 78. State Rep. Gina Mason died. She was in her first term representing Lisbon in the Maine House. She was also the mother of State Senate Majority Leader Garrett Mason, who plans to run for governor next year. Gina Mason was 57. We began by talking about moxie as a character trait. We'll end by talking about it as a beverage.
I prefer mine, room temperature, and a little bit flat.
That's Frank Anicetti. For decades, he owned the Kennebec Fruit Store in Lisbon, but he was best known as Mr. Moxie.
I go through about a half gallon a day.
No way.
Oh, yeah.
Moxie was created as a medicine in 1876 by a doctor from Union. But in 1982, Frank Anicetti created the annual Moxie Festival.
I get calls and letters daily from all over the country if I can ship Moxie, ship T-shirts, history of it, and it just goes on and on.
In 2005, the legislature declared Moxie the official state soft drink. Frank Anicetti died in May. He was 77, but the Moxie Festival lives on. Next year's begins July 13th in Lisbon. Erwin Gratz, Maine Public Radio News.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And for Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine, Friday, December 29th, 2017. Thanks to Keith Shortall and our digital team, I'm Ed Morin.